Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. We follow up on the work of Russ and Pam Martins of WallStreetOnParade.com and several other mainstream sources chronicling the rash of bank employee deaths in the last 3 years. Pam Martins points out that though the financial crisis took place from 2007 to 2010, a series of employee deaths occurred at the largest U.S. bank on Wall Street, J.P. Morgan Chase, which began in December 2013 and stretched into 2015, though J.P. Morgan Chase alarmingly stands out as having the most unusual frequent young employee deaths. There are many more within the various mega banks. Pam and Russ Martins also note the significance of death benefit policies among U.S. banks and corporations that exceed $1 trillion. BOLI, or bank-owned life insurance, and COLI, corporate-owned life insurance, have become known as dead peasant insurance because many companies take out policies on employees in bulk, including rank-and-file workers. Megabanks are allowed to secretly collect life insurance proceeds on the lives of their employees and former employees without disclosing the amounts to the families, the public, or shareholders. These life insurance policies are so secret, even Congress has difficulty getting answers. The patterns within the lists of bank employee deaths is complicated. Some cases that mainstream media report on reveal what seem to be murders that are reported as suicides. At a glance, some of these deaths appear to be those with conscience going up against the systematic corruption within the banking system. Not unlike corporate and military whistleblowers, scientists, and holistic doctors. We welcome back our guest, John Lorden, who has presented data analysis of the unusual and tragic loss within the alternative health medical community. John is a former entertainment technologist for 20th Century Fox, TV Guide, and Cirque du Soleil. John Lorden is now the host of Brain Scratch on YouTube's Geek and Dorks channel and a show that explores mysterious occurrences and cases where the official explanation just doesn't seem to fit. John, welcome back to Another News.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I reached out to you for some data analysis on the series of banker deaths. We've had a week or so to look at the cases, and we're still grappling with this list. But before we focus on the really unusual and linchpin cases, I wanted to get your comments, if any, on the entire picture of banker deaths.
Yeah, it's a very deep and wide rabbit hole, and I think anyone that is interested in this topic would be really well served to do some of their own research, jump into this, and try to help people analyze this. It is such a big task. I've seen there is kind of a core list that has about 50 different bankers, and they're mostly suicides. There's a few homicides that kind of pop up, but most of them are suicides, or they're at least being called suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of the alternative media, some bloggers and smaller sites have reported on it, but this has gotten picked up even all the way up through the New York Post. And it's interesting to me because I know last time I was on with you, we were looking at holistic doctor deaths, and there was some very specific conditions when you're looking at that group where you can say, does this fit a theory of some kind? This group is extremely interesting because they're in some way attached to the finance industry. Like I mentioned, most of them are suicides, but it's literally worldwide. And there are some publications like Wall Street on Parade that have keyed into certain theories around certain clusters. For example, there's more than 7 or 8 people that have died that worked at J.P. Morgan Chase. And they have certain theories about why that might occur. There's many people that have been dying in Europe and could be attached to the LIBOR scandal that happened out there. So there's kind of another sub-theory about that could be occurring.
Mm-hmm.
But when you just look at the sheer number of this, it's mind-boggling. There's so much to try to go through to try to get your hands around what is really going on here.
Pam Martins and Russ Martins from Wall Street on Parade examine some dark incentive here with the bank-owned life insurance, and because the banks are actually profiting from the deaths of their employees. And even Congress can't even get the full picture. The laws are so vague, and even shareholders who you would expect would have access to this type of information if they've bought shares in a bank that they trust to give loans out to businesses to make money.
That topic kind of goes to a real interesting place for me as well. If you do a YouTube search on bank-owned life insurance, surprisingly what comes back are many people talking about that product and trying to sell it to banks. And it gives you some very interesting insight into what this product actually is. It's not limited only to the thought of, like, we think of traditional life insurance. You know, someone dies, there's a beneficiary, and they get a certain lump sum of money. This bank-owned life insurance works in a very different way, where it's almost its own investment. Even at the time they're putting into it, it is seen as an asset. They're allowed to grow that money and make money off of that account even before it actually pays out. And all of that is not taxed. And then when the payout does happen, that's not taxed as well. When you look into what this product is, I think that's part of why they're able to hide some of the mechanics of how it works, because it's almost working like a trade secret within a company. They're talking about being able to offset the costs of vacation time and medical expenses and all these, you know, somewhat growing costs for their employees with the money that they're making on these bank-owned life insurance policies as they're growing, even before they cash out.
Yes. And also what's important for listeners to know is that the money doesn't go to the families of the deceased. And
right.
Interesting, but that's how these banks profit. According to data from the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council, and it was a holding combined at a total of $68.1 billion. So four banks' individual BOLI assets are as follows as of the end of last year, and this is 2013. Bank of America, $22.7 billion. Wells Fargo, $18.7 billion, JPMorgan Chase, $17.9 billion, Citigroup, $8.8 billion. That's just a little bit of a background of the bank-owned life insurance practice.
Yeah, there was also another real interesting tidbit that I saw on an article on Wall Street on Parade about that, where even if the worker is no longer employed at the bank can still collect the death benefit, and they actually routinely conduct what is quoted as death sweeps of public records using former employees' social security numbers to see if that former employee has died, and then if they have, they go ahead and submit a claim for payment on the death benefit.
Somebody wrote in a message on one of these articles, if somebody asked you to work for JPMorgan Chase, just say no.
I would certainly think twice about it, especially after doing this research. But that's another thing that kind of struck me about looking at the videos where people are trying to sell the bank-owned life insurance. Just the manner that they describe it, they talk about it like it's this premium product that is bulletproof, that you can make money on year over year even if the economy is doing bad. It just has all the hallmarks of sounding like one of those things you don't want to get involved with. Too good to be true, almost.
I was going to say it's like gold.
So yeah.
It's really odd to me. I don't really understand the financial mechanics of it, to tell you the truth. I don't know how it works. I don't know where the money comes from and where it goes.
Comes from the bank, and that's part of what makes it easy, at least in terms of how they sell it, because the bank doesn't actually lose the money. They take what is cash that is sitting as cash, and they say, okay, we're going to open some policies on some of our employees. But as soon as they, quote, invest that into this asset, that still stays on their books. So even though they're transferring this money, they're essentially transferring the money kind of to themselves, but then they pay an outside company to manage the actual contract, to manage the death benefit contract. Stays on their books in a very strange way, like I mentioned, not taxable. They could liquidate it instantly. There's a lot of, it sounds like one of these wacky products that, of course, the public will never see. You'll never be able to buy anything close to this. But if you happen to be a multimillionaire, you might be able to get into it. And if you own a bank, this it's basically made for you.
I wondered about, are insurance companies actually involved with this?
That's a really good question. I think that's where it starts getting into some of those trade secrets. I have not been able. I know that there's an insurance company that manages the contract process, but in terms of the money actually moving to them, from what I saw, that does not appear to be happening. The bank is essentially creating a account for itself and then putting money into that. That money is then put into other investments, so it's allowed to accrue and compound. And at no point does that ever get taxed, even when it makes money in that. There are some caps to it, like it can only make a certain amount of money per year, but apparently it's pretty generous, and there's really no downside to it. I mean, if you do think about the basic mechanics of a life insurance policy, it's going to pay out. At some point, even if you are just making money off the death benefit alone, that money will pay out. So the question is, are the payments that you've made, the proceeds that you've put into it, do those ever exceed what the death benefit is? And it seems to me like this system, they've kind of found a way around that, where they're essentially holding the asset themselves.
And making big profits. Okay, so yeah. The possible murder of Melissa Millen in Connecticut, and she was the senior vice president with Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance. And according to Millen's profile, her work involved the general management of the bank-owned life insurance, among other things. I know you looked into this case. Can you tell listeners what you found?
Well, this is one of the few that is actually labeled a homicide. She went running. She went out on a running path, and she was found with a stab wound to the chest with an edged weapon, and that is, it's kind of strange because some of these cases you look at and you're like, you know, they're saying this is a suicide, but could this person have been pushed out a window, or could something else have happened here? Mm-hmm. And in most of the cases, you'll see they defer to suicide, but here, you know, when you have a stab wound to the chest, it's pretty hard to say that. I don't know if they actually found the weapon. I don't believe that they found the weapon at the scene, which is also probably helping to categorize this as a proper homicide. And according to some information I found, she apparently had access to highly sensitive data on the bank profits resulting from the collection of life insurance proceeds. So she kind of was square. I mean, if we're talking about bank-owned life insurance, she was squarely in that business and had sensitive knowledge. So if we're looking for a possible motive, that could be seen as a possible motive. Frequently when I'm looking into mysterious murder cases like this, the family is looked at, of course the spouse is looked at, and I did find some notes that her ex-husband is not considered a suspect in this. So it's looking like it could be business related, possibly.
She has two school-aged children, and her body was spotted along a jogging path that ran parallel to the road, and a motorist spotted the body. This is November 20th, so I guess the leaves are off the trees, so you can see right through. All right, so John, that's Melissa Millen, which is a suspicious case in itself. Let's turn to two more interesting cases, one from 2014 and one from this year. The things that they have in common is that it's in a particular area in Hoboken, and it's Matthew Genovese and Andrew Yarch. Can you tell listeners what you had found in these cases?
Yeah, there are some striking similarities, but let's start with Andrew. He was out with some friends. He got pretty intoxicated. It was noted that he was drinking pretty heavily. I believe about 1 a.m. he tells his friends that he is leaving, but he's going to come back. He then apparently heads towards his apartment. He is seen by someone else falling off of a shed behind his apartment. the person goes and talks to him and actually tries to pull him out of the back area of the apartments, and he is apologizing profusely. He's saying that he didn't have his keys. He essentially had locked himself out. So that witness leaves him. He eventually seems to get into his apartment, changes into running clothes, and goes running somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, he is found, unfortunately, in the Hudson River.
Right. The last image of Andrew Yarchik is a blurred, poor-quality video of him running along Hoboken's waterfront. And he was allegedly training for a marathon. And this was March 30th, 2014, and he was allegedly training at around 2 a.m.
Which is very strange, let me just put out there. I mean, I don't know. I know that New York has a bit more nightlife than the, you know, California life that I've led. I've trained for marathons several times, and typically I do my runs in the morning. I think the earliest would be 5 a.m. or something like that, but I would never think to do a distance run in the middle of the night after I had been out drinking.
I would say that's pretty dangerous to do to begin with.
Yeah.
To your body, and you're just pushing all that alcohol through your system.
Oh, it's yeah, you're going to be dehydrated. I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong in that case.
I guess an unusual decision for somebody like Andrew to make, given his background. Let me see, he lived in Hoboken for roughly a year before his disappearance. He grew up in Hamilton, New Jersey. He was a wide receiver on the high school football team at Steinhardt High School. He attended Susquehanna University and graduated in 2009 with a major in finance and financial economics. On March 30th, he disappeared. A neighbor told police they saw him at 1:30 a.m., and then he was later seen in running gear outside his apartment, training for a marathon. Now, there's something weird here about the surveillance cameras, John. This is 2014, and a restaurant surveillance camera near 4th and River Streets captured him jogging south toward Hoboken Terminal. And it's probably pretty cold outside. Almost a month had passed before they found his body. So at the time, the city drew criticism for its long-defunct surveillance network.
I did find note that there was an incident earlier that March in which a Wharton, New Jersey man told the Hoboken police that he had been thrown into the Hudson River by three assailants dressed in black. He actually wound up holding onto a pylon near Pier C Park until police were alerted and rescued him. Now, the police said that they had trouble corroborating the man's story, and when they were trying to follow up with him, he basically refused to talk. But it was a strange little wrinkle that I found in that.
Was that written by a reporter?
I have a few links on that. It either came from NJ.com or HudsonReporter.com. I think it's interesting. You know, that's kind of the situation. If you do imagine that there is someone out there trying to bump off bank employees for any kind of reason, you know, how are they going to do it? And it's a pretty interesting story to hear someone say that, hey, earlier that March I was out there and someone threw me in the river, you know, three guys dressed in black.
And that's the end of the information, and the police don't follow up.
Right. Well, no, the police tried to follow up, but the man basically refused to talk to them.
Which is weird.
Yeah, and could be seen a few ways. It could be seen that he was potentially lying and didn't want to get in trouble for wasting their time. Could also be seen that he was silenced. Someone got to him and told him to let it go.
Okay. But I guess what we're looking at here is this particular location is becoming very notorious. And I think it's called Frank Sinatra Park, right around that area, by the way. Anything more on Andrew?
No, that's it for Andrew.
Okay, now, what did you find out about Matthew?
So, in a very similar way, Matthew Genovese, in January on the 23rd in this year, 2016, is 24 years old, an associate with a Manhattan tax consulting firm, and also in a very similar way goes out drinking, but he is noted by people as not being particularly intoxicated. He leaves somewhere between, he leaves Bloomfield Avenue specifically, somewhere between 10:30 and 11:30. His home was only 10 blocks away, I think in the west direction, if I remember correctly. And for some reason, he heads east and is once again found in the river. And they have a detective that found his wallet and his car keys at the edge of the river, and his wallet actually still had its cash, the credit card, and his ID still in it. And once again, when we talk about the cameras, there's the surveillance cameras out there had a known issue back in 2014, which I kind of honestly thought was a little ridiculous. There was a problem with a network repeater, and it wasn't connecting to the cameras, and that was kind of the reason why apparently we didn't have any footage of what happened to Andrew. So the city caught some flack for that. They said that they were going to address it. Apparently they have installed, not just installed more cameras out there, but actually started having routine police force out there just to monitor it. And we get to this case with Matthew, and he goes into the river, and unfortunately none of the cameras are shooting the spot where he went in, which was along Pier A.
It's a very interesting case. In one article, it reads, his house is a 10-minute walk a block west, and the bar that he left is called McSwiggin's, and it's a major, major snowstorm, and I remember it's very, very cold. I don't even know why you would walk down to the Hudson River because of the wind. It was a blizzard, basically.
Yeah.
What do you think about the wallet and keys on the boardwalk?
Well, the first thing that hit my mind was, you know, was he attacked by someone? But then when you consider that it still had its cash, credit cards, and ID in it, the first scenario I would think is some type of robbery, you know, him being mugged or something along those lines. But no, everything valuable was left behind. So then my mind goes to, is this a suicide for some reason? Did he just, you know, go out, have a nice dinner, have a couple drinks? In particular, because there is some motivation for him to be walking in the direction that's opposite from where his home is. So something had to motivate him to at least go walking in that direction, maybe not necessarily jump. And you know, when you think about his car keys and his wallet, why, even if you're going to leave some indicator that you've disappeared, I kind of understand the wallet because it's got your ID in it. If you want to leave some trace of where people can find you, that might be a good method for doing that. But leaving your car keys, that's very, very curious to me. I'm really not sure how that could happen. Now, is it possible that he was attacked and these things fell out as he was, you know, being pushed over the edge or something like that? I think that's something that needs to be considered as well.
And another interesting aspect here is, you know, a snowstorm would cover up a lot of evidence of other people being there. So not only did you have the surveillance camera network out, but you had a snowstorm that could cover up tracks of other people being involved along with his own, creating this mystery. But your thoughts on the motivation to walk east toward the river is interesting. I didn't really think about that. So the car keys being left behind is something that stops you from thinking it's a suicide?
Not necessarily. It's kind of a strange thing to me. The situation where he might have been attacked in some way. You know, many of us are aware that car keys can be a very good weapon, particularly if you make a fist and you're able to poke some of the keys through in between your fingers. Was he using them to try to defend himself in some way? I think there's some possibility of that. I would hope that, you know, he at least would have left some blood or trace evidence of the person he was trying to fight off, if that's the case. But then you have to also wonder if that was going down, the person that eventually threw him over the edge, why wouldn't they have taken those items or just tossed them in the water after him, unless, to your point, the snow was at a level where they kind of sunk into the snow and the person just didn't see them.
In this article by New Jersey Advanced Media on NJ.com, The city has been working for several years to replace its surveillance network. The cameras are currently in place in 8 locations along the waterfront and should be functional soon. Somebody with the city had made that statement.
I mean, that's just amazing to me. I mean, how many cases do you need to happen down there before you get that? And it's technology. What's holding it up? It's only a matter of dollars to really get those things going.
The reason we mentioned Matthew Genovese is because he was an associate with a Manhattan tax consulting firm for companies that do business overseas. And the disappearance of these young professionals is suspicious.
Yeah, and it's very disturbing. I mean, these are people, in some cases, that are extremely young. I found just today when I was looking up some recent cases, I found 2 that were noted by the Times of India. One of them was a retired banker. He was a bit older, but the other was a 28-year-old bank officer who hung herself in her room just this past 4th of July.
And what bank?
I don't remember off the top of my head, unfortunately. I wasn't familiar with them. They weren't tied to the kind of major banks that the same names that we've been seeing pop up on this.
Well, John, in the introduction, I mentioned that, you know, at a glance, some of these deaths appear to be people with conscience going up against a corrupt system. It's similar to any corporate or military whistleblower or even holistic doctors or certain groups of scientists who don't go along with the corporate line or who don't go along with things and maybe have an alternative view. What are your thoughts on that sub-theory?
I think it's very valid, in particular when you look at the work done by Wall Street on Parade and consider her past and where she came from and the type of analysis that she's providing now. I think that good people in those situations will turn into this type of rebel. And I think it's necessary in some way because so many people have lost so much. I mean, particularly what we went through in 2008. I mean, but even looking farther back than that, there used to be a time where our savings account would make enough interest that, you know, if you had 100 grand in savings, you might be making 10 grand in interest per year. And nowadays, you're lucky if you hit a point or two. And it's effectively, in some way, some people are saying that it is robbing the middle class. So when you have people that are in these positions where they can see what's happening from inside, if they are good people, I think they're going to be moved to do this. You also have cases of where there's bad people that are working in these situations, and what are they going to do? There's another death that occurred. His name was Richard M. Talley. Mm-hmm. This one is from February 4th, 2014. He was a CEO of American Title Services, basically a real estate title company, and he was 56 years old, killed himself, supposedly, with a nail gun where he shot himself in the chest, I believe it was 6 times, and then put one into his head for the 7th time, and apparently that was the fatal one. And his company was under investigation for basically embezzlement. And it turns out that that's true. His company was effectively embezzling millions of dollars in these transactions. So there is something. When I look at the industry, the banking industry, and when you consider even, you know, celebrities that get in trouble for getting insider trading information and things like that, mm-hmm. you have to have a very strong moral fiber to be able to work in an industry where and be creative and think, well, I might be able to do something if I knew this information ahead of time. And, hey, could I make a little underground connection with some people over in this other bank? And, you know, if we jacked a number up here and they jacked a number up over there, I think there is so much temptation in that industry that it can really bend people the wrong way. And luckily, I think there are heroes in that. And when you look at this list, the full list I have is 71 names. what's the likelihood that at least one, if not several of these people are that good guy, are that person that was trying to stand up? I think the likelihood of that is extremely high. I think the bigger question is, are these deaths all natural? Are these true suicides? Are these true accidents that are occurring? Because some of them seem extremely convenient and seem to benefit the larger organizations that these people might have been standing up to. Mm. So when you look into this, you're going to find several main theories. Are they being killed? And if they are, is it because that they were going to reveal that the banking and credit system is crooked in some way? Or another theory is that it's failing, that some of these people are able to see what happened in 2008, see that the same game is being played in different industries. I know a lot of people are very critical of the student loan market that has been just exploding exponentially over the past decades. So are these people whistleblowers looking to end this same process of pump and dump? Are they being killed or removed because they're aware of this type of ongoing market manipulation? Are they being killed for the benefit of bank-owned life insurance, like we had talked at the start of this hour, to get that final cash out to keep those numbers afloat? And I mean, you're talking, the amounts that you had mentioned are before the payouts and potential interest are even accrued, which can sometimes take those numbers tenfold. So in the example where you said $68.1 billion, the eventual payout for that might be closer to $680 billion.
You got it.
It's a crazy number
right.
When you look at this.
I know. I thought Pam was making a mistake at first, and then I realized.
Yeah, no, she's absolutely right. And you have to look at all the different ways that they capitalize on those funds for that money to come back that way. But I found several sources that were effectively saying the same thing. There's also, I mean, if you're looking at the potential theories for why this list is so big and constantly growing, is there something just natively wrong with working in this industry? Is there something about, and when you look at the statistics of occupations and suicide rate per occupation, finance workers on several lists does come up high, frequently in the top 10. I looked at some information that was posted from businessinsider.com. They have it listed at number 5 in terms of occupations with the highest suicide rate. And at another article at therichest.com, they have it at number 3. And according to this data, which was collected from 1984 to 1998, they looked at 11 million death certificates. And this data is specifically for white males that are in these jobs because they're comparing it to the national suicide rate for white males. Finance workers are 51%. More likely to kill themselves than people that are not in that industry.
It's very odd. Now, I know, understand there are suicide hotlines and things like that, but I'm wondering, is there anything out there, any kind of resource for a person of conscience that is on the inside and saying, I can't do this anymore. I know what this is doing to the larger picture. And I wonder if there's anything to help people like that. They can just go somewhere and say, hey, I need to just sit down and talk to somebody because this isn't right.
Yeah, you make a really good point. And I think it goes even beyond the scope. I mean, you could say, well, you know, hopefully they have a therapist or someone to speak to about that. But with these unique pressures, you know, being responsible for other people's money, sometimes recognizing that there's systems that are working against the customer that you're supposed to be serving, those seem like pretty unique concerns. And I think you raise a good point that there should be some way to help those people. I think that Pam did probably what I would suggest most people should do if they find themselves in that situation, and that is to re-engineer your life. You can tell that this woman still loves finance. She still loves the deep research that she has to do, but now she has pushed it towards writing about this and being free of the constraints of working within that type of organization.
Yeah, she's quite an amazing person, great writer. Her and her husband, just without any experience, put that website together, learned how to do it, and really impressed with her.
But I'm also impressed at how far they go, like, you know, them actually putting in Freedom of Information Act requests and really trying to understand the details at a much deeper level. And then even when those things don't pan out, it still gives you a lot of insight into kind of the problem that's going on with that industry. I mean, if you've got shareholders not even able to understand the mechanics of the business that they're invested in, that seems like a pretty good indicator for a shady practice to me.
Did you by chance see that letter, the response that she got back from the Office of Currency Comptroller from D.C.?
Yeah, I did.
Which declined information on the bank-owned life insurance systems she was asking about. Getting back to people of conscience, this might be a case like that, but the New York Post articles that you you sent to me, can you talk about the banker deaths on that?
Yeah, Michael Gray had done some reporting at the New York Post, and what I'm most kind of excited about by that is it's finally this type of theory hitting a mainstream media source. And he went as far as there are several videos that you could see that have been produced around this. And he's really tracking. He was looking primarily from 2013 to 2014. But there are a few cases in particular that are pretty compelling. One of them is David Rossi, who on March 6, 2013, at the age of 51, somehow fell out of his office window, which was only on the third floor of the building that he worked at. And what's interesting about him falling out, he was a communications director for what's known as the world's oldest bank, and I'm going to butcher this name, but it's Monte dei Paschi di Siena. And what's interesting about this is they have footage of him as he hit the ground. There was a camera that couldn't have been set up much more perfectly for seeing what happened to him. And as you see him fall and hit the ground, he's actually facing the wrong direction for what most people would consider a suicide. He's facing the building, which is extremely strange. And considering that it's only three stories, you know, personally, I mean, I hope that this thought never comes into my mind that I would act on. I'm going to look for a taller building than three stories, because three stories might not kill you.
And
as a matter of fact, he goes on to live for about 20 minutes after he hits the ground. Now, what's strange about this is two men actually come up and look at him while he's on the ground and then turn around and leave without doing anything.
It seems that they were checking on his mortality.
It certainly does, and I don't think it's very often that we see footage where you can actually go and review it for yourself, but any listeners out there that are interested in it, that is some of the most compelling footage I've seen that'll really make you think twice about that being a suicide. However, it has been classified officially as a suicide.
And that surveillance camera footage came out, I believe, this year, and it's been several years. It's just been sitting somewhere until just recently. John, you also looked into the investigative work of, I think, the New York Post on William Brokesmith. Can you tell listeners about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a 58-year-old man. On January 26, 2014, he kills himself, found hung by a dog leash that is being held up in a door. And he had left multiple suicide notes in a dog bed. He was also clutching some financial paperwork. There are some very strange things that happen where an employee of the bank actually comes to the scene, seems to be going through the paperwork, seems to go through his computer. And he is a former senior risk manager at Deutsche Bank. And this one happens in South Kensington, London. The other thing pretty interesting about this case is the suicide note that was left for his wife, now his widow. Her name was Antonella Tognazzi, and he calls her Tony in the suicide note, and she says that he never, ever called her Tony.
Wow, I didn't see that. That's extremely telling. And she also said in the interview that it looked like he did kill himself, but it looked like he was forced to do it.
Yeah, and I think his stepson also came to that same kind of conclusion. That, and it is a pretty interesting theory. If you think of someone being forced to kill themselves, being forced to maybe write all those letters out, are they going to try to leave some little trail, some little wink at the person in the letter that, hey, you know, something's going on here. This isn't just me writing this. And I have had one other case where it was a missing person case, and the sister actually contacted me to cover it. And one of the things she was most disturbed by is that her sister used a giant lowercase a at the start of her name, and she says her sister never signed her name like that. It was always a proper A.
Okay, so it could be a signal and, or a somebody else writing it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I believe his family believes that he actually did write these things. It's just the question is, was he being led to this?
Okay, now let's look at the other aspect of it. And what was the job of William Brokesmith? And what was the context of this in your perception?
Well, he's former risk manager, which sounds like a title I certainly would not want. And from what I understand, he seemed to be under some pressure, in particular at his job. I saw a quote that he had said something about not wanting to take on some type of responsibility that they were asking him to take on.
Now, John, wasn't there an issue with conscience of William Brokesmith at that time? I believe there was some kind of regulatory inspection coming up.
Yeah, and apparently he was not seeing eye to eye with a coworker who is responsible for profit, and he is essentially responsible for identifying risk. And there was he was pretty vocal about the fact that he didn't want to be sort of misrepresenting himself by going into this inspection with the method that they were currently looking to do.
Well, John, this is very interesting work. We just scratched the surface, basically. And one of the mega banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, is coming up as just an alarming number of banker deaths. And she had written something kind of interesting. Ohio is the home to the headquarters of J.P. Morgan's largest commercial bank, J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A. And as of March 2014, that bank held $1.3 trillion in deposits, representing the life savings of average folks across America who wander into the bank's 5,900 branches spread across the country, unaware that part of the bank's profits are derived from the untimely deaths of workers. And the bank's Ohio headquarters are located at 1111, that's 1111, Polaris Parkway in Columbus. A facility described in the 2011 article in the Columbus Dispatch as a 2 million square foot city unto itself. And clearly, the Ohio Department of Insurance has no idea what's going on inside this, quote, city unto itself. I just want to give listeners a little bit of context of what some of these banks are doing. And John, after reviewing some of this material, what are you left with here?
I'm certainly left with feeling like people might not know what they're getting into going into this profession. I don't foresee that these types of scandals are going to end anytime soon. I think that there is always going to be some game at play. And if you're going to take on a job like this, you have to really check within yourself and see what type of person you are before you step into this world, because the pressures of it seem astronomical. If nothing else, we could look at the peer data and see there are an awful lot of people that are killing themselves that are in this profession. And is that really even mentally healthy for the people that aren't killing themselves? You have to wonder.
What kind of work environment is it for those who can last without being suicided or killing themselves?
Yeah, and are you okay with your employer making a ton of money off of your literal life?
John, tell listeners, what else are you working on?
I am going to be starting a new podcast very soon, but the usual place where you can find me is on YouTube, my show Brain Scratch, and the show about missing people, Brain Scratch Searchlight. I have a new episode of each one come out every single week.
I will definitely be looking forward to that, and thank you again for being on In Other News.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
John Lorden. Thank you very much, John. As I mentioned, many sources are reporting on banker deaths, including the mainstream media such as the New York Post. And if you're interested in researching more into the series of banker deaths, there are plenty of areas to cover, such as investigating a list of those who leaped from buildings. WallStreetOnParade.com points out that J.P. Morgan's peer banks, such as Citigroup's, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have not reported any suicides resulting from leaps from buildings in 2014, nor have they had an alleged brutal murder-suicide by a long-tenured technology executive. Of the 473 people who committed suicide in the city in 2008, the most recent year for which statistics are available, 93, just under 20%, did so by leaping to their deaths. I also want to review some key points about the bank-owned life insurance connection. Pam Martins clarifies that, quote, J.P. Morgan's corporate profit center that revolves around taking life insurance policies on the lives of tens of thousands of its workers, which pay to the corporation, not the family, upon death, naturally draws speculation about these unusual worker deaths at such young ages. When young workers die, it can shorten by decades the amount of premiums the corporation has to pay out before collecting the death benefit. Both the death benefit and the buildup in the cash value of the policies are reported as tax-free income to J.P. Morgan to fatten its profits. Yes, knowing this bit of information could make the series of young banker deaths somewhat less random. Today, banker-owned life insurance and corporate-owned life insurance are closely held corporate secrets. And as mentioned, even Congress can't get answers. At a hearing on October 23, 2003, before the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Charles Grassley explained how the General Accounting Office attempted to conduct a survey into the matter, but was thwarted by the failure of the parties to turn over information. And another piece of information here, the Justice Department, the FBI, congressional committees, and the New York State Attorney General's office are investigating the stock and future markets that are being rigged by some Wall Street firms using high-speed computer technology in conjunction with algorithms deploying artificial intelligence. The investigations gained momentum after best-selling author Michael Lewis brought details of the allegations to light in his book, Flash Boys, and the shared allegations with millions of Americans in a March 30th appearance on 60 Minutes. And another book that Pam references, titled The Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers, by Ellen Schultz. And then you ask yourself, what kind of legislation is put in place to reform? Well, clearly the Glass-Steagall Act was not reintroduced. However, the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation was introduced in 2009 to promote the financial stability of the United States by improving accountability and transparency in the financial system to end, quote, too big to fail banks, to end, quote, too big to fail, to protect the American taxpayer by ending bailouts, to protect consumers from abusive financial services practices, and for other purposes. The bills that came under Obama's proposal were largely consistent with the proposal, but contained some additional provisions and differences in implementation. So if you're following up on some of this information, there is recent news on the Dodd-Frank reform legislation. The Volcker Rule was not included in Obama's initial June 2009 proposal, but Obama proposed the rule later in January 2010 after the House bill had passed. The rule, which prohibits depository banks from proprietary trading, and in parentheses it reads, similar to the prohibition of combined investment and commercial banking in Glass-Steagall Act. Well, that was passed only in the Senate bill, and the conference committee enacted the rule in a weakened form, Section 619 of the bill, that allowed banks to invest up to 3% of their Tier 1 capital in private equity and hedge funds, as well as trade for hedging purposes. The initial version of the bill passed the House largely along party lines in December by a vote of 223 to 202. And passed the Senate with the amendments in May 2010 with a vote of 59 to 39. If you're looking to follow up on investigating more into the banker deaths, send me an email at inothernewsradio@yahoo.com. Maybe we can cover that information on this show. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archived shows. I'm gonna go get some more.